Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection on KSK Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. 8 days ago at 3:17 p.m., 30-year-old Anchorage resident Jonathan Gilbert was pronounced brain dead after suffering a gunshot wound to the head. After 2 days of searching for compatible recipients, a specially trained team of surgeons took him to the operating room to harvest his organs for donation. Later that night, Jonathan's heart, kidneys, and liver were transplanted into waiting recipients in Washington. Jonathan's tragic death, along with his heroic choice to be an organ donor, means that at least three other people will be given the chance to continue their lives. Please join us today with my guests from Life Center Northwest as we explore the organ donation process and honor one man's heroic choice to share the gift of life. Even as another has ended. My guests today, as I said, are from Life Center Northwest, Val Murray and Sonia Krenzelok. And a special guest, didn't quite put it out there because I didn't know if she would join us, but Jonathan's mother, Danita Gilbert, has come on the show. We really appreciate having her here. And I appreciate all you. Thanks for taking the time to join me today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right. I want to remind listeners how we can be reached. You can call us locally at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. You can reach us on our toll-free number at 1-888-353-5752. And you can email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. Please remember you have to spell out line one. That's L-I-N-E-O-N-E in order to get it to us. Please call in if you have a question about today's topic or if you've had experience with organ donation, either a family member who was a recipient or somebody in your life who has been an organ donor before. If you want to share that story or make a comment, please don't hesitate to give us a call. It'll add something to our program. So I think before we get started, there's a statement or something. I'll let Sonia explain it, that they read, so she can lead us off.
Sure. It's our donor appreciation statement, and I work primarily with the hospitals. And before we really do anything with the hospitals, whether it's education or a meeting, we really read the statement as appreciation, and I'll just read it, that we're reminded every day that donation is a rare and remarkable process. The generosity of the person at the center of this process, the donor, touches everyone who takes part, from family members to medical professionals to transplant recipients. So,
and that's read before any sort of...
Really, before we do any education, again, I work primarily with the hospital, so before we do anything, before a meeting, before that education, wherever the opportunity arises, we really want to appreciate the donor, because that is at the center of our process.
It's just taking a moment to remember what you're all doing and to honor that.
Absolutely.
All right. I guess I'd like to hear a little bit from each of you from Life Center. What your role is there, how long you've been involved with them, and exactly what you do with the organization.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I'll go first. I'm here local in Anchorage, Alaska, and I do the hospital development side of organ donation. So what that means is I work primarily with the hospitals and make sure that when we have an opportunity for a donation to happen, everything moves as smoothly as it possibly could go. So whether that is ongoing education, checking updates on policies, et cetera, but just making sure that all that compliance piece is taken care of.
All right, Val?
Yeah. Again, my name is Valerie Morey, and I work as a family support specialist for Life Center Northwest, and my role has changed over the years that I've been with the organization. I've worked for them for 17 years and have worked in their aftercare program, doing follow-up with donor families, connecting them with recipients, and more recently have been working with our staff who go on site to support families at the hospital while an organ donation is going on. And I also train our staff, work on training our staff on a continuing basis in how to interact with families at this really vulnerable time, how best to support them and really bring them into the vision of what organ donation can mean for them as well as for recipients. So I'm honored to do the work. I have a background in counseling and didn't really know about organ donation before I worked for Life Center Northwest and totally fell in love with the mission and the families that we get to work with during the process.
All right, thanks. I guess I need to disclose my own relationship with Jonathan. I've known Jonathan for, he's 30 now, and I've known him for 22 years, and I've known Danita for 22 years, so our families go way back. We're pretty close, I would say. We have sort of a bond around Jonathan, or JJ as we call him. Danita, why don't you just take a second? I know we both know that Jonathan, I mean, he signed up when he was like 17 or 18 years old to be an organ donor because he thought it was important. Can you talk a little bit about Jonathan's decision there and maybe a little bit about what he's like?
Sure, Prentice. Jonathan was just an extremely beautiful soul. He loved people. He loved life. He wanted to make sure that this world is going to be better and that he wanted to leave a footprint. He showed his heart to the world by being a volunteer soldier as a member of the local Elks Post 2868, as a political activist for Alaska Healthcare when he was a child.
Yeah.
Recently, he added EMT, so he just was always helping people. For a time, he had a business in Washington State, and it was a courier business. It was Black Sea Couriers. He was very proud of it. But his most, or his greatest achievement, he felt, was when he would be picking up the donated organs from the airport and then delivering those donations to their intended destinations. And we talked about that, and that just made him feel really good that he was helping and was part of that process. And then we discussed, well, I'm an organ donor, so this is how it's going to be if someone can use my organs. And I'm like, well, that's great. I'm one, too. And so that, you know, a lot of his family felt the same.
Yeah, I remember getting a call from him a couple of times. He's like, guess what I got in my car, Pops? And he's like, a lung or a kidney or something. And he was taking it. He took it very seriously. It was something that he really felt good about contributing. So I guess to start off, I want to start off with, I guess let's talk a little bit about the organization, the organ donor process. Somebody comes in to the hospital. How does that get started?
Sure, I'll start us off with that. And I guess I'll start with the compliance piece, and that is that CMS regulates that all deaths are called in to us, and we triage that out and really look at potential, and we'll get into the potential later talking about how rare organ donation is, but there are these clinical triggers that that the hospital alerts us about, and then the phone call is made, we respond and come on site and really start to collaborate with the hospital staff. And if there's any potential, which again, I need to emphasize that the potential is very, very low with organ donation. And then we are kind of behind the scenes collaborating with the staff and the next steps. And then I'll let Val kind of step in.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go back because you mentioned a couple of times the numbers. So let's let's go back and sort of establish that, because what are we talking about as far as the number of people who are waiting for mm-hmm. organs and how that compares with the number of available organs?
Sure. The number actually, according to UNOS, which is the United Network for Organ Sharing, as of yesterday, the wait list continues to grow, and it's about 120,000 people on the wait list. And then I guess in 2015, there was about 9,000 organ donors nationwide, which equated to about 25,000 organs transplanted. So you can see there's a large gap in that number.
What is the, there's a lot of reasons that people die. There's a lot of different ways. And what percentage of people who actually are organ donors, like I think everybody in this room is an organ donor. What percentage of people who make that choice are actually able to give organs?
Sure. In Alaska, we have a high registry rate of about 86%, and that's always changing by a percentage here and there. Montana is a little bit higher than that. And I mentioned Montana because that's our region. Our geographical region is WAMI, Washington, Alaska, Montana, Northern Idaho.
Okay.
And so Montana is 89% registered individuals. Now, that doesn't mean that you're going to be an organ donor. Chances are you will not. And so just because it has to make donation happen, it has to be in a very controlled environment, which might be a misconception out there that everyone is able to be an organ donor. So out of all the deaths in the hospital, less than 1% have the opportunity to move towards organ donation. So it's a very small percentage of individual. And that's why we keep saying and repeating that it's a rare and remarkable process, because it's such a low percentage.
Yeah, most of us think that when we die, our organs can be donated to someone else. And the reality that I found out when I started to work for Life Center Northwest is how seldom that actually can happen, because of the circumstances that have to be in place in order for somebody to be an organ donor. They have to be in the hospital, have a severe neurological injury of some kind, and be declared brain dead, and then their organs can be recovered for transplant. And that happens very rarely. You also have to be a fairly healthy individual. So it really doesn't happen as often as we think because of the circumstances. Because the organs, in order to be transplanted, to be healthy for the recipients, have to have a blood supply until right before they're recovered for transplant. So it's way different than I pictured before I worked for the organization. And most people think, of course I'll be an organ donor, I want to help others, and you can't do that unless you die in a hospital with that brain injury and are declared brain dead.
Right, so if somebody dies of cancer or if they die in a car crash outside in the hospital, it just takes essentially a couple of minutes for everything to lose viability as far as being available for a transplant. So it's a certain number of circumstances. Those numbers of percentages of people who register for organ donor seems pretty high.
It is. Like I said, Montana has the highest, and we're the second highest in the nation.
Okay, because one of my questions was, if everybody signed up to be an organ donor, would we have people on the waiting list still, I suppose?
Yes.
All right.
You get a double answer there. Yeah, there would still be a lot of people on the waiting list.
All right. I'm curious, how many lives, like if you think about organ donation and how many lives are saved? I'm sure you guys track that as far as like successful transplants, people getting their lives prolonged every year. Like how many lives?
Well, I guess I'll just repeat. In last year, there was 25,000 transplanted organs. So 25,000 lives saved.
Okay. Yeah.
And then I guess from our region, I'll just say our region is, again, WAMI, and we had 640 organs transplanted. And Alaska contributed to that number with 77 organs transplanted from Alaska.
Okay. For those who might be tuning in late, my guests today are Val Murray and Sanya Krenzelbach from Life Center Northwest. And Danita Gilbert, who is the mother of an organ donor, Jonathan or JJ Gilbert. Our topic today is organ donation. As always, you can reach us with your questions or comments at our local phone number. That's 550-8433. You can call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And you can email any questions or comments to line1@alaskapublic.org. All right. So somebody comes in. The decision's made to move forward. You mentioned brain death. Let's get into the that. What does that mean exactly? And I guess, Sonia, you're going to take that one?
Sure, with Val's assistance.
Okay.
I guess I'll take a step back and just mention the Uniform Declaration of Death Act, UDDA, from 1981. And that just states, number one, the irreversible cessation of circulatory and respiratory functions, and two, the irreversible cessation of all functions of the entire brain, including the brain stem. So brain death is actually death by, they call it neurological criteria, and it's diagnosed by or conducted by a skilled physician. And once brain death is confirmed, then donation can move forward. And that's at the point when the OPO, Life Center Northwest, takes over patient care and the billing of all the of that patient. And then the hard work starts for organ allocation, for example.
Okay, let's talk about a little bit more about brain death from the family's perspective. I know for me anyway, and I'll ask Danita, you know, I mean, the doctors initially told me that there wasn't any chance for recovery, but there's certain criteria, like JJ came in, Jonathan came in very cold. He was at 89 degrees, and they have to warm him up and have him in that warm body temperature for 24 hours prior to being able to clarify or call brain death. And as that process was happening, we were all, you know, waiting and hoping. And I mean, it's natural to hold out hope. And when he was pronounced brain dead, or they said that, it was a whole nother round, you know, of grief. It was, you know, we all knew it. I talked to the doctor. I know the doctor. I trust the doctor. But still, it was a whole nother round. And Danita, can you talk about that process a little bit for you from the family perspective, how you guys were dealing with that and feeling about that?
Right. We got to the hospital probably close to 24 hours later to be with them. And, you know, at that point, you're just wanting them to be surviving. You don't know what they've survived, but you want them to be surviving. And so we were, you know, waiting for him to get better. Some sign that something was going to be better, not as tragically horrible as it just really appeared. It was quite apparent to us. It was very bad. So, you know, when they informed us, they were like reheating his temperature so that they can make a determination of brain death. That was kind of like a holding pattern. And I agree with you that there was another realm of death when he was declared brain dead the next day. It was just, okay. So you kind of just took a step back because you're holding your loved one's hand. You feel a warm hand. You feel life in them. And it's just hard to, from a family point of view, to disassociate that he's not possibly present with you anymore in that moment, but his body's alive. So yeah, very different.
So at that point, the family support person comes in for the hospital and begins to have discussions with the family, right?
Correct.
How do you make contact? Who do you go through? Who do you talk to? What's that process like? I guess Val, you're the person to answer that. What are the steps, the next steps, once brain death has been determined?
And there's a lot happening behind the scenes with us, even before that point. And We work really closely with the hospital team to gain as much information as we can about the family dynamics, what's the family's understanding of what's going on, is there something that we're going to go in there and clarify about, and we always do include in our conversation what's your understanding of what the doctors have told you, or can you tell us what the doctors have told you, just so that we can go over it again, because it is so hard for families to come to grips with that reality. We want to make sure that we're not saying organ donation before they've really begun to accept that this is not going to be survivable. So we do a lot of work behind the scenes, talking to social worker, chaplaincy, bedside nurses, doctors, everybody that's there, to gain as much information as we can about what's going on for that family. And then we have a conversation and with the family members, hopefully in a private setting, so that it's really hard to have that conversation at the bedside. Feels disrespectful somehow to be talking around the bed about the person. So, right. And it's one of the most difficult conversations you can have with another person, to be with them in that trauma that they're in the middle of, but it's also one of the most honorable things I've ever done, is to be with a family at that moment, because they're letting you into their own personal journey, and you get to walk with them for a little while in that journey, and hopefully be able to help them have something good come out of a really tragic situation. So we hire people who are experienced in that realm and really going to be compassionate with families, and yet be able to guide families through to the next steps in the conversation, so that we don't get lost with them in their grief and their sadness. So, and sometimes we have a doctor come back in and explain brain death again, because it is a hard concept to understand, and we recognize that and want to do everything we can to help families get to that point. It's kind of like the stages of grieving that you have to work through to acceptance that this is the reality really quickly there at the hospital. And we wish that we could talk to families after it was all done, but that really isn't possible. We have to talk to them and begin our process of finding recipients for organs in order for the miracles to happen for other people and for the donor family, for that good to come for them too.
Okay, I'm gonna go ahead and ask a hard question, because in doing research for this, you know, show, you Google brain death, and mm-hmm. then you start coming up with all these people that have these miracle stories and people coming back, and how do we know, even family members saying, well, we need to give it some more time, how do you know, how is brain death different than a coma or a traumatic injury that somebody's not going to recover from, but they could lay in the hospital? How do we know that brain death is irreversible?
Yeah.
And you're not, there's no doctors here. So if you can't answer that question, that's okay. I mean, I get that.
Yeah. But
you probably get that question all the time.
We do. Yeah. And, it's really hard to come to terms with that for a family member. Somebody you love is lying there and their chest is still rising and falling, and yet you're being told that they're not coming back, that they're gone already. And so we do whatever we can to, because it's the hospital doctors who are declaring brain death, so it's a really separate process from us coming in and talking about donation. So, we know that people do Google brain death and come up with stories, and the stories are, if you look into them, they're people who weren't actually declared brain dead. There are people where somebody thought that they might be brain dead, and they did testing and found out that they weren't. And so there's never been a documented case of somebody being an organ donor, and you know that it wasn't all done properly. So most families, it's really amazing how often families do come to terms with it. And while we're in the process with them, I'll say to a family member, kind of what's going on, what are your thoughts? And they'll say, I know he's gone. I can tell. I can really feel that this person is not here anymore, that it's just kind of the shell. I had a donor mom who said, it's like an empty glove. The hand that animated that glove is no longer here.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and we do whatever we can to help families to understand that. And, but it is a difficult thing. And we want families to really go back again and again to the doctors for explanations. I had a family who came from Montana over to Western Washington, and the mom of this family was declared brain dead, and her husband was going to have to go back home and explain it to the other family members who were at home. And we had the doctor come back in and give another really clear explanation. You can show brain scans to family members and, you know, show them that there is nothing left in the brain, that it is all gone. So, you know, we do whatever we can to get past that hurdle.
Does the family have, I'm sure some families ask for a second opinion, or, I mean, is there a process that you go through to, if someone asks for another doctor or somebody to do a different thing, do you honor that?
Absolutely. Yeah. Whatever they need. And, you know, a lot of families are praying for a miracle at this point, and we do not ever want to get in the way of, you know, that process of a family that's praying for a miracle. And sometimes they come to see that the miracle is maybe that they can save other people's lives in this time.
If someone's an organ donor and the family refuses or says, no, we're going to wait, we mm-hmm. don't want organ donation, I read somewhere that legally a doctor can move forward with it. But how do you handle that situation?
Well, once somebody is declared brain dead, a hospital won't keep them on the ventilator. That, you know, they will until everybody comes and says their goodbyes.
Right.
So even if organ donation weren't going to happen, they would be taken off of the ventilator. But when a family is having a hard time with organ donation, it's my belief that it's not really about the organ donation. It's about the death, that they're really having a hard time coming to terms with that. And that's a really natural reaction. And it's our job to do whatever we can to support them to come to terms with the death, because often when they're saying no, they're not saying no to donation, they're saying no to the death. And that's very understandable. So we do whatever we can to support them through the process and make them as comfortable as they can be with it. And, you know, really, I have a coworker who says signing up to be a donor on the registry is the ultimate absentee ballot. And, you know, once somebody has voted, you can't overcome that vote. You can't say, no, I don't think that was a smart choice. And you have to go with the higher intent of that choice, which is to help others and save lives through the gifts that are given.
All right, Danita, what was that process like for your family, for, I guess, our family to get? I know what it was like for me. I kept waiting. Every test that the doctor did, I was watching for something, and How did you get to okay?
We recognized early that Jonathan wanted to be an organ donor. So that helped right away that we were in agreement with that. Yes, we did. Some of us have our own time to deal with the issue of what is brain death? Is he brain dead? Do I trust this doctor? I want a miracle. Will he come back and it not be actually brain death? So we did, you know, amongst ourselves as a family. I think all of us had our own ways of progressing through it, but for some it was a lot slower, and because I would agree that it was mainly due to the fact that we weren't ready to lose our son, our brother, a husband, you know. He was 30, and that's an early loss for a family. So, and also it was a brain injury, and that was also a very sudden, tragic death also. So, yeah, I guess they will mostly all be that way for an organ donor, is what I'm learning now. I also assumed that everyone could just donate because I'd marked the donate box.
Right.
So, you know, but I know that the team that was working with our family, they were very good with us, and they were very accommodating and allowing us our emotions. And, you know, if we had a question and I said, well, I think we should ask the doctor again for this clarification, they were, you know, definitely supportive of that. Just because they were walking with us through that time, and they advocated for the family as well as helping us along the way with Jonathan's organ donation.
All right, we're at the halfway point of our show, so we're going to go ahead and take a short break. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. My guests today are Val Mori and Sonia Krenzluk from Life Center Northwest. Danita Gilbert is also here, the mother of organ donor Jonathan Gilbert. Our topic today is organ donation. You can call us on our local number at 550-8433. That's 550-8433 if you have a story about organ donation or a question for our guests. Or you can call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And you can email your questions to us at line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll continue our conversation about organ donation. I'm Prentice Pemberton.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line One on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on KSK Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just tuning in today, my guests are Val Mori and Sonia Krenzluk from Life Center Northwest, and Danita Gilbert, who is the mother of organ donor Jonathan Gilbert, who died last week, who was also a very close person to me, an important part of my family. So our topic today is organ donation. You can email your questions or comments about today's show to line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us locally. Our local number is 550-8433. You can call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And you can please remember that the show repeats tonight at 8. So if you're listening to this on Monday evening, you'll be hearing a taped recording, and we will not be accepting phone calls. Speaking of phone calls, we're going to go ahead and come back from the break with a phone call. We got Penny, you're on line one. Welcome.
Hello. This may well be the strangest question you've ever gotten, but here goes. About 10, 15 years ago, I donated my entire body in advance to a place in Oregon called BioGift Anatomical. I have carry a card in my wallet that says, if you find my body, call this number, and they take care of everything. But I've recently found out if you had too many organs removed, as in surgeries, they will not accept your body, and you should have a backup plan. But they don't tell you how many surgeries are too many. So if they don't accept my body, can you guys still take what organs are needed?
That's a great question. Yeah. And complex.
It's very complex.
Do we have an answer?
Well, I would say, again, if the circumstances are set up to where organ donation is a viable option, death in the hospital under ventilated care, then yes, organ donation is a possibility. So we possibly could move forward with, recovery of organs, I guess.
Now, Penny, quick question.
Yes.
Is
can
your
you be a backup? Can you be a backup recipient if the original place I've donated to won't accept my body?
Yeah, because it sounds like your donation is for research.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So if the research place won't take her and Penny's on life support and there's something that can be used, can she sign up as an organ donor, say an advance directive to say, if not this, then I'd like the rest donated to organs, to Life Center. Is that kind of answer? Is that your question, Penny?
That's my question.
Okay.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. The answer is she should. Now let's talk just real briefly about advance directives. Those are important. And Penny, I think to have your wishes clearly spelled out in a advance directive that says you want it first here, and then if not, please donate any tissues or, because we're not just talking about organ, we're talking about tissue and corneas and other parts of the body that can be used for many different purposes. So can maybe Val, you're the person to talk about advance directives briefly?
Sure. Yeah. When you sign up at the DMV, when you get your driver's license, or you can go online to sign up to be an organ donor, that's a little bit different than an advance directive.
Correct.
You could always put in your advance directives that you would like to be an organ donor too. But the thing that's gonna flag us that you are a registered organ donor is through the DMV or the online registry process. So, but advance directives are really make life easier, as does the designating yourself as a donor through the DMV for your family members. Because if you don't have those advance directives or are not signed up to be an organ donor, your family will be asked what their choices are. So it's really good to speak to your family as well as doing the legal paperwork.
Does that help, Penny? I think Penny might be gone. Thanks for the call, Penny. I really do appreciate the question. And I think advance directives are important. That's advance directives, a living will. That's a health document. It's an official document that any hospital has the paperwork for that. You can, any lawyer, I think you can do it online, I'm sure, nowadays. But it really spells out and it makes it easier on your family to make those decisions about what you might want. Another question that pops into my head right now is, if someone is not registered as an organ donor and they're, let's take Jonathan, if he wasn't an organ donor and he was in the hospital in the condition that he in, brain death, young, healthy, good organs, can the family make that decision and call and say, we would like to do this?
Absolutely, yeah. And there are a lot of families who do bring up the option of donation before we even have a chance to go and talk to them. The families will bring it up just because there has been more publicity about the good that can come through organ donation. So, yes. And when we talk to families about donation and they say, well, why wouldn't they have registered? My answer is usually that the DMV is a weird place to talk about end-of-life decisions. So some people prefer not to sign up on the registry while they're getting their driver's license. But we ask families to make a decision based on the character of the person who died. Were they a giving person? Would they want to save another person's life if they had the opportunity? And it's a really rare circumstance when a family will say no.
No, they would not.
Yeah.
They don't want to save anybody's life.
That would
be odd. So that is still a gift that a family can make.
Yeah.
Unless they have an advance directive for some reason that somebody says they do not want to be an organ donor.
Correct. And then we honor that. Absolutely.
Okay. If you're just tuning in, my guests today are Val Murray and Sonia Krenzluk from Life Center Northwest. I think I've gotten their names wrong all day, but so please forgive me. And Danita Gilbert, the mother of a recent organ donor, Jonathan Gilbert. Our topic today is organ donation. You can call us with your questions or comments at 550-8433. That's 550-8433, or call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. The last way you can reach us is to email your questions. That's to line1@alaskapublic.org. So if you have a story or a question for our experts or for Danita, our family member, please don't hesitate to call. One thing I do want to get to is families of donors, and I know this is something that Danita and I have talked about, is you're really curious, like, where did they go and where did these organs go? We know Jonathan's liver, kidney, and heart were transplanted, and you want to call those people and say, hey, how's your dad, or how's your son, or how's your, you know, but you can't do that because there's a balance there. So how does that process work? I guess it's kind of like an adoption a little bit. So who wants to take that, Val? Or
I'll have Val speak on that.
Okay, Val.
I'm happy to. That's the best part of what we do, is that connection that can happen afterwards with recipients. And in Jonathan's case, there are four recipients out there,
okay,
whose lives were saved. So both his kidneys were transplanted, and his liver and his heart. And we will send a letter to his family a couple of weeks after the donation, after we've gathered the information from the transplant centers. So we work on the donor side. The transplant centers work on the recipient side. So we coordinate with them throughout the process, but really they care for the recipient. So we don't have a lot of information about those recipients. We put together as much as we can, tell families about the recipients with a little paragraph about each one, with as much information as we get from the transplant centers. And then we encourage donor families sometimes to write to recipients and tell a little bit about this person who gave the gift. It's really therapeutic, I think, for families to write a letter and say, this is Jonathan, and this is why he would have wanted to help you. A lot of times recipients don't write a letter immediately, and it all goes through letter writing in the beginning, just because there is confidentiality involved. But recipients feel like they have to get healthy before they write the letter. They have some survivor guilt that they're alive,
right,
and their donor is not. So it's a complicated emotional process sometimes.
Somebody had to die for me to live.
That's what they think. And I had one donor mom who said, that's not the way it is. He died, and then you got to live. It wasn't because, you know, he didn't die because you needed to live. So it really is an amazing connection that can be made between donor families and recipients. I've had, and if both sides agree to meet in person, we can help facilitate that too. I've had a donor mom listen to her son's heart beating in the recipient's chest.
Wow. And
those meetings can be extremely therapeutic, comforting, emotional, really, really nice when that can happen. And it doesn't always happen.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are times when we can make that work, and it's a wonderful connection that gets made between the two sides.
I just got goosebumps when you talked about the heart beating.
Yeah.
I'd like to go to the phones real quick. Judy, you're on line one. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. What a great topic. My question is about our daughter. She has been in a persistent vegetative state for about 16 years now due to an automobile accident, and she suffered a traumatic brain injury. And she's on a respirator, but well, not really respirator. She has a tube, but it's just for suctioning her lungs so they can get a better suction. She's on a feeding tube, but she breathes on her own. And we're wondering about the viability of her organs for donation after such a long period of time. And what would happen if, like, we took her off her feeding tube, how long, you know, would her organs be viable then, if they're even viable now?
Yeah, really, really good questions.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. And I don't know if I have all the answers in this case, but the organs need to be perfused with a blood supply until right before the surgery happens to recover them for transplant. So it's really 60 to 90 minutes, you know, from the time somebody is removed from a ventilator. There are some cases where people can be organ donors when they're taken off a ventilator. They're not officially declared brain dead, but if they die pretty quickly, then their organs can be recovered.
Right.
But
she's not on a ventilator. She's breathing on
Yeah.
Right.
And that's what would stop it, I think, because if you took out the feeding tube, it would take a long time, or, you know, it would take a while, I would think.
I had
some personal experience with that as well, with somebody, you know, not eating, and it takes a while. And so I just want to say thank you for thinking of that. That's a really generous thought on your part, and I wish that we could make it happen, but it sounds like it probably couldn't in this case. But keep asking those good questions.
Now I have a question.
Okay.
If Judy wanted to get in touch with somebody and talk about this and sort of set it up and get more information in an ongoing way, could she call you guys and talk about this and continue that conversation as she goes
yeah.
through this?
Yeah, she could call us, and we could definitely talk her through the process, but it would be with a primary doctor that would be set up, and then we would have to coordinate, you know, what the timing would look like after she was taken off of the support that she's on.
Judy,
we're really, you know, torn. We don't really want to put her through what happens after you remove the feeding tube.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
You know.
It's a tough spot. I had a friend who was in, her daughter was in a vegetative, well, not vegetative, but pretty close for many, many years. So a lot of sympathy to you, and thank you for the call.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you for taking our call, and thank you for your help and all the work you do. Thanks.
All right. We're going to keep going with the phone calls here. Mary, you're on line one. Go ahead.
Hi. I love my doctors and have great faith in them, but ethics are always a question in our world these days. So my question is, the doctor who makes the declaration of death, does he have any influence over who receives the organ?
What a great question.
Yeah. And I'll take the answer offline.
Thank you, Mary.
Okay.
Sure. I guess I can start us off, and then Val can help me out here. And the answer is no. The declaring physician is separate from anyone in the transplant team, and so it's really a separation of responsibilities there. And it's just as a protective mechanism to separate that out, to protect the hospital, protect the family, and really adhere to all the ethics.
Yeah. And if there are any questions ever, we do often consult with hospital ethicists about any questionable circumstances. So that's a really good service that most hospitals provide now, is to have ethics consults.
I know Regional does, and I'm certain, because I worked at Regional for a long time and I had this conversation a lot. You have a board. I mean, you have a group of people that will look at a case and really go through it, and especially if there's a disagreement with family. Right. Nobody takes that lightly, and they work really hard to do that. We have one more call. Lucy, you're on line one. Thanks for the call. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. My husband was an organ donor, and I wanted to make a couple of points about it. He had a simple fall and actually had recovered for a few days, and we thought things were improving. When I got the surprise call that he had had a sudden brain herniation, I'm a nurse, so I bridged that gap pretty quickly. But amongst that terror, that horror that I heard from the physician, I immediately clicked on the fact that he had a When I Die file, and he made it very clear he was a donor. And I told the doctor immediately, he's a donor. Please work towards that as I gather family and head in. The next couple of days, it took a couple of days because he had some issues with his heart, but he was a very young man, and I believe he made 7 donations. My next journey in this process was when they reached out to ask if the donors could contact me, and I said, well, of course. Much to my surprise, it was difficult to receive that.
Hmm.
I didn't respond right away, and I still to this day can't tell you why, because I'm fully supportive of it, and his selection of being a donor made the process to lose him so much easier. But my nieces actually crossed paths with them by one of the social networks and opened that up, and we had a wonderful dialogue. And when I found out the lives that these people had lived, it was just another beautiful part of that story. And then I want to thank you for the annual gathering that you have in celebration of the lives. I have yet to make one. We're 9 years into this, and I still can't tell you exactly why. But I love being invited, and I thank you for what you do. And I would say to everybody, make a When I Die file. Make it easy for your family to make this decision for you. And continue your support for these people. It was and still is, 9 years later, and an amazing journey for us to go down. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Lucy. That's really good to hear. And the annual event that we have for donor families in the Anchorage area is a wonderful gift. I think all of the 17 years I've been doing this, I've come up for it, and would love to see you at one of them one of these days. I just wanted to mention that Providence, Alaska, now has another way of honoring donors. They have a donor wall where they tell the stories of organ and tissue donors that happen at Providence, Alaska, and it's an amazing thing to be able to see those stories on a screen in the hospital lobby.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Lucy. Providence also does something. And Danita, can you tell us about the flag raising and what that was like? Jonathan's going to be super happy to be on the wall of organ donors, by the way, like to have his picture there and his story. So the flag raising, can you describe that a little bit, Danita?
I can try. It was really quite a ceremony, and it was very respectful and observing Jonathan and honoring him for his donation. Um, there was some prayer in there and some blessings in there, and to bring peace and to again honor his choice. They discussed, to clarify that it was their hope that he would live on in others, as it was our family's hope. To stand there and watch the flag be raised, and to be told it was going to be Jonathan's flag up there for 5 days. I think it was good for us.
Danita, what's this all, been like overall, like as far as an experience goes, the organ donation process? I know it's been incredibly hard for, especially for you and his, direct family, but for mine as well. But what would you say your take home kind of point for folks, for families?
It is valuable. I agree with our last caller being a journey, definitely. It's going to be a journey. But we're strong, strong family, strong community. We are grateful and happy that Jonathan will live in others, that he was given the ability to be a hero in a way that he loved people. And so he was giving another piece of himself, literally. And so that's wonderful, and it was a lot of memories, and we did some special things, like retrieved a handprint for a special quilt, a handprint for possible picture, just things to have memories that are tangible. We were very respected at everyone's different levels of grieving. Personally, I've been all about being positive and personal growth for quite a few years, but these last possibly, 2 years, it's one step forward all the time. And I love my family every chance that I get. And I told my son I loved him every chance I got. So I was grateful for him leaving his imprint on the world.
Thank you. Take home points, just 10 seconds. Val?
Just the recipients of these organs express how hard it is to say thank you, and that there are no words, but they're going to dedicate the gift they've been given to helping the world.
Sonia?
Sure. My take-home point would be check the box, but please inform your family members. It certainly helps the process in the end.
All right. I want to thank each of you, especially you, Danita, so shortly after. Thanks. Some people who have lost a limb continue to experience the sensation of pain from the lost limb. What's going on? How is this possible? On the next program, Dr. Woodard and his guest, pain specialist Andrea Trescott, discuss unusual pain syndrome. That show is on January 9th at 2 p.m., repeating that same evening at 8 p.m. Dave Waldron was our web editor and audio engineer for today's show. Thank you for taking the time to join me today on Line 1. I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a good day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.